So how does the scoring work with the falling plates? I know you get 10 points for each plate, but okay, let's say you and I are competing against each other and I take 6 seconds for the plate rack at 10 yards. You take 3 seconds for the plate rack at 10 yards.
Same score. So the timing is a par time. So you have 6 seconds at 10 yards to shoot all six plates. At 15 yards, you have 7. At 20, you have 8. And at 25, you have 9. And the scoring is you get 10 points and an X for every plate you shoot. So if there is a tie on the stage, you have to go have a shoot off. And then it's the first person who misses loses. And they decrease the par time as well. So so you get 5 seconds. And so that's how they break any ties on that stage. Is with a shoot off.
Okay. All right. So is everything a par time then with Bianchi?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, everything is limited, or what do they call it? Then Virginia count in USPSA limited in IDPA. Everything is limited. You get prescribed amounts of time to shoot the course of fire based on the distance, difficulty, and that sort of stuff. The mover is the only one where the par time is the same for every string of fire because it is dictated by when the mover appears and when the mover disappears.
Gotcha. Do you have the fins on your revolver for the barricade?
No, that's open gun stuff.
Open only?
I shoot production. So, and I was part of the initial, and I think part of that is because I was part of the initial push for production in the sport. When Tom was there, he introduced the production division. I was there for the inaugural year that it was a championship division. Dave Savigny won it that year with like an 18-14, I think, with a basically stock Glock 34. I've pretty much always shot production. I only ever shot metallic, which is like limited, as a second gun. It's like, because you used to be able to enter two guns. You could shoot your main match gun, and then you could shoot your secondary gun. And that would count for an additional prize, which was called the aggregate score. So like the two gun aggregate score, and you would get guys who would shoot open and metallic to get that two gun ag. I did that a couple of times, and I was like, "This is a mental grind. Like this is difficult."
Wow.
Yeah, it's tough. So this year, of course, I'm doing it. And what CMP's done,
the masochist
is. Yeah, what CMP's done that's clever is they have you shoot, they'll have you shoot your second gun all in one day on Tuesday, and then you'll shoot your main match on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. So what I'm doing is I'm going to shoot rimfire production with, I've got a Taurus 992, which is 9-shot 22LR. So I'm going to shoot that in rimfire production on Tuesday as sort of a warm-up, and then I'm going to shoot my Model 66 as my main match gun over the next couple of days. So just two iron sighted guns, just banging on triggers. It's going to be fantastic.
The 992, does it have adjustable sight?
It certainly does. Yeah.
Okay. So you're able to dial that in as well then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now you seem to shoot, we're going to switch gears a little bit. You seem to shoot, obviously you've been an IDPA member since, what it was, 2008, you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So like August of 2008. So why I enjoy IDPA. So this is not a, why are you shooting IDPA? That's ridiculous question. I enjoy it. But what is the draw for you in IDPA?
So, and just to, hang on. I just want to, be clear. I've been a USPSA member for a really long time too. Let me see. According to,
you're just giving your money to everybody.
Yeah. Okay. So this thing, I think it's important to support the shooting sports, right? Like, if I want, here we go. Here's a fun fact. I joined USPSA before I joined IDPA. So I joined USPSA January 24th of 2006. So I've been a USPSA member even longer than I've been an IDPA member.
Almost 3 years longer. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, these days so last year I shot a ton of IDPA, and I shot it because I love USPSA, and I think USPSA is a great place. And it's a great place to challenge your marksmanship skills and to really push yourself. Because I do a lot in the self-defense civilian sector with revolvers, I wanted to stay with IDPA because IDPA is the last place other than I-Corps, which there's not a lot of I-Corps shooters out there. But if you have a six-shot revolver that gets fed from speed loaders, which is the revolver that most people have, IDPA is where you need to go to be competitive with that. You know, I would say go shoot I-Corps Classic Division or the World Revolver Series in their Classic Division, but those matches are few and far between. So if you've got, you know, a Model 19 or a GP100 or a Taurus 65 or one of those, you know, six-shot 38, 357 guns, and you want to go compete with it, IDPA is the place. And I think there's tremendous value in competition shooting. And I also think for normal people, right? Like if you're not going to become a serious USPSA shooter and, you know, spend all the money on the gear and dry fire in your basement and, you know, alienate your friends because you're going to matches every weekend and stuff like that, I think IDPA makes sense. It makes more sense for people who are just, you know, carrying guns out in the earth, and aren't necessarily interested in becoming sportsmen, because it gives you access to shooting under time pressure. It gives you access to novel situations that you would not encounter otherwise. Like in IDPA matches, I've had to sit in a car and safely draw my gun and exit the vehicle and engage targets around that vehicle, or shoot out of a vehicle, or shoot around props, things like that. I've had to carry items in my hands while shooting at the same time. So I think that exposure to novel situations that are also reflective of things that you may have to do in the real world is beneficial in IDPA. And while I would never go so far as to call it training, because training is a different thing than competing, to me, there is more value for, again, your regular earth. Like there's so many people out there who have concealed carry permits and they've taken two or three classes and they're not really interested in becoming a training junkie or Eric Griffel, but they still want to do something a little bit more with their gun. IDPA is the perfect place for them because it will allow them to build those gun handling skills, increase their marksmanship proficiency, and again, encounter novel situations that you wouldn't otherwise encounter in a safe and controlled environment.
Yeah, I mean, those competitions are the greatest feedback of your training or whether you need more training, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the first time you go to an IDPA match and you empty half a magazine at a 15-yard pepper popper, you go, oh, I need to practice or something.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, this is some of the things you touched on, like props and things like that and different shooting scenarios is why I like IDPA. I have a background in bullseye as well. 1990 Marine Corps rifle team, high power NRA is what we competed in. And then I was a sniper instructor for 4 years. So all my stuff's been more precision oriented. And I like that IDPA puts a little bit more of a premium on accuracy. So there are a few rules that I would like to see them alter, but in general, I like the premium on accuracy. And, you know, I've been in that scenario where hands start on a lawnmower and then you've got to, at the beep, you got to shove the lawnmower and then it activates a swinging target right in front of you. So I like that kind of stuff. I think that adds a little bit of excitement and gun handling, different gun handling techniques to matches.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I agree with you that the high level, so I actually did like the math, and IDPA places a higher penalty on misses and no shoots than USPSA does now. It didn't always used to be that way, but when IDPA switched to a 1 second per point down versus half a mm-hmm. second, that calculus really changed. And I'm okay with that. Again, for a sport where you're going to see a significant number of participants coming from regular earth concealed carry people, I want them to be highly accountable for each shot they fire. I want them to think about the consequences of shoot throughs and pass throughs and angles and target presentations and things like that. You know, and as far as like the rules go, I don't think any shooting sport is ever going to be perfect for me, but you know, having shot IDPA all the way from the time where it was like invisible cover lines and procedurals for breathing out of order. And, you know, I remember the year where they banned reloading on the move. Like even if you were behind cover and you were moving from a position of cover to another position of cover, you could not reload because you could not reload on the move. And it was all static reloads. And that was probably the dumbest rule I've ever seen in IDPA. And thank God they got rid of it. But what's interesting about, and I will say this, to give credit to IDPA, they have been fairly responsive to the things their membership wants. You know, they allowed appendix carry before USPSA did. They allowed weapon mounted lights before USPSA did. You know, so they were far more responsive to trends in the concealed carry community than USPSA was. And I think rightfully so, because it says defensive right there in the name of IDPA.
Right. Agree. I wish they would. I'm still not a big fan of retaining your magazine if it has a round in it. And I also would like to see them allow shooting on the move from cover to cover. So, because that's not unrealistic.
Yeah. You know, again, like I said, that, you know, there's things that I would love to see change. And I think that's one of them. I think some of the rules they have right now about like being in the open and surprise targets and stuff like that are a little herky jerky. But again, it's so funny because I don't think of myself as having been around for a long time, but I've been around the sport for a really long time. And I have to look at it in the context of what it was when I started doing it and where it's at now, you know, and it's been, and IDPA has without a question gotten better in the time that I've been shooting it.
Now you mentioned ICOR. Have you shot any ICOR?
Yeah. So when I lived in Indiana, I was actually the match director for an ICOR club. For our ICOR club, I shot a couple of club matches and really enjoyed it. During the pandemic, they were letting people like mail in classifications and stuff. So I, you know, had a buddy who was an RO. We set up a bunch of classifiers and I just ground my way up to master class in ICOR in their classic division. That's their six shot speed loader division. And I feel like the ICOR championship is in a place where I could actually get to it this year, but I'm not 100% sure of that because I've always wanted to go shoot the IRC, the International Revolver Championship, which is their big championship match. I am a life member of ICOR. It is October 17th through the 20th this year in New Tripoli, Pennsylvania. I have no idea where that is. It's funny because the IRC has always, for whatever reason, fallen on a weekend that conflicts with something for me, whether it's, you know, Air Force stuff or something like that. But it looks like, nope, I got a conflict. Hang on. Yep, got a conflict that weekend. Yeah, it's not going to happen. See, told you, every year I have a conflict with the IRC. So I have not gotten out there yet. Maybe I'll try to shoot one of their other regional matches or something this year.
Maybe you can reach out and say, hey, I'd like to sponsor, but I need it to be on this weekend next year.
Right. I'd have to beat Ruger to the punch because Ruger is their title sponsor and they actually,
I gotcha.
Yeah. And good for it. You know, Smith and Wesson, you know, used to really care about this, and they've just kind of bowed out of a lot of it.
Is there any type of revolver competition you have not shot?
Probably. You know, there's
but you're not aware of it.
Yeah. Oh, well, so there's it's not an I-Corps spinoff, but there's a new, there's the World Revolver Championship matches, which are kind of a West Coast thing. A lot of the guys who did that were, you know, West Coast I-Corps guys, are still I-Corps guys. And, you know, we're actually sponsoring their World Championship match, the WRC, this year, as the title sponsor. And I was going to go shoot that, but now I got to go to Africa instead for a hunt. So, damn.
Well, shucks.
I know, right? My life's so difficult.
So where in Africa are you going?
South Africa. I'm not 100% spun up on the details of where we're going yet. I know I'm flying to Joburg, and it's like a 16-hour flight. So.
And what are we hunting?
All kinds of stuff. They sent over a list of like all of the animals that are on the safari package. One of them is a zebra, which I would love to shoot a zebra. I think that would be, I want to shoot the Disney animals, right?
Oh, that's hysterical.
Please, no one clip that out and cancel me over it. No, but in all seriousness, I've heard that zebra are like super tough, and they print. So I'm not a hunter in the sense that like I get out of bed and think about hunting. All of the hunting that I've done over my life has either been, you know, as part of my job in the firearms industry, or, you know, a couple of friends or something like that. And what interests me in hunting isn't like the chase or the pursuit or anything like that, but it's being presented with novel marksmanship situations that I wouldn't find somewhere else. It is being presented with complex marksmanship challenges that I likely wouldn't find in other scenarios, which is why I've largely avoided, you know, sort of like tree stand deer hunting, right? Because can that present complex shots? Absolutely. You know, you could get a deer that peeks through the bush at 200 meters and, you know, you've got like a quartering shot on it or something like that. So yeah, it can present complex marksmanship challenges, but by and large, the odds of that are much lower than other stuff. So the hunting that I've done, I do because it presents complex marksmanship challenges. Like, I really enjoy coyote hunting. I've done some prairie dog shoots. I like any red-blooded, you know, God-fearing American, I will shoot wild pigs given the slightest of provocations. And then my favorite type of hunting is pheasant hunting, because I lived in South Dakota, and pheasant hunt and wing hunting pheasants is hunting pheasants is great because it's civilized. You get up at like 8 a.m. and then you have breakfast and you go walk through a field with some of your friends and you shoot things out of the sky, and then you go have a lunch, and then you walk through a field a little bit more and you shoot some more stuff, and then you go have a nice dinner, and there's no being cold in the freezing rain waiting for some stupid ass deer to come wandering into your gun sights. No, it's good hunting. It's the sport of kings. I love pheasant hunting. So the first pheasant hunt I ever did was when I was moving to South Dakota many years ago, and the company that I was working with at the time, we were invited to the governor's pheasant hunt, which is where they bring in like businesses they're trying to recruit into the state, stuff like that, or established businesses, and they all go out to different places and you shoot some birds. And the state of South Dakota did not have a capacity limit for shotguns during pheasant hunting. I did not own a pheasant shotgun, but you know what I did own? A 3-gun shotgun. So we're walking out in the field, and you know, there's these guys next to me with these beautiful side-by-sides and over-unders, and you know, just like nice shotguns. And I've got this Mossberg with a big ass extended magazine tube on it that I stuffed all the way full of shells. And we're walking through this field, and a bird flushes, and the guy next to me shoots at it and misses it. And then the next thing that happened, it was nighttime over Baghdad circa Gulf War round one, because I throw that gun into my shoulder and I go, boom, 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 boom. I shot it like 4 or 5 times and I caught it with like the last, like the fifth shot, proving that in pheasant hunting, if you have enough ammo, you can miss fast enough to catch up. But I was not interested in like traditional pheasant hunting. I was like accuracy by volume all day long. Everybody else shot maybe, you know, 15 or something rounds that day. I went through like 2 boxes of shells because if I saw something, I lit it up. I was like, nope, we're shooting at it. I don't care. Because I like shooting and I got better, you know. I don't do that anymore, but it's just, it was so funny because it was like, it was so civilized and like, bam, 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 bam. Yeah. So, you know, bringing that 3-gun sensibility to a upscale pheasant hunt with, like, you know, wealthy people who are there because they know the governor was quite a fun experience. I was a lot younger back then. I didn't know any better.
I'm envisioning, as you say that, the old World War II videos of the kamikaze attacks and all the guns on the ships just firing into the air.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, that. Yep.
Oh, now do you have, does your schedule allow you to shoot many matches this year, like national level matches?
Last year I shot a lot. You know, part of what we were doing as a brand strategy for Taurus USA was putting the brand out in front of people. So I kind of went on a tear through IDPA matches, shooting Revolver, sponsoring them, you know, shaking hands, giving away guns, stuff like that. This year, less so. I'm busier one at work. And, you know, so I'll still be at some matches. Like I said, I'll be at Bianchi Cup for sure. I'm going to try to get out to a couple here or there, but it's just been a little bit fewer this year than last year. But I do still have the opportunity to travel, to shoot matches, take classes, you know, teach classes as well.
Now, I know you guys sponsor Jesse Harrison and KCUCBO.
That's correct. Yeah.
Do you guys have any other professional shooters, if that's what you want to call them, that you sponsor?
Yeah, we have Trent Eichler. He's our junior shooter, although he's not going to be a junior much longer. Trent finished top 5 in single stack at Single Stack Nationals last year. Does a ton with single stack, great shooter, fun dude too. Like, he's a good, like, he is actually a kid, so I can say he's a good kid. But yeah, no, we're super happy to have Trent as part of the team and to represent the junior brand.
What about from a revolver standpoint?
We don't have any revolver guys yet, because right now we don't have a competitive revolver product for USPSA right now. However, right now, and I'm also, you know, more than happy to fill the role of the token wheel gun guy in the interim, but I'm open to it. You know, if in the future we were to have, say, I don't know, a 8-shot cut for moon clip, 6-inch revolver with fiber optic front sights and a really good trigger in the future, hypothetically, that might be an avenue that we would pursue then.
Okay. So you might get a few knocks on your door if hypothetically that were to happen in the future, right? Yeah,
if hypothetically that were to happen, I might go knock on somebody else's door and be like, hey, would you like, you know, some money and, you know, this gun that obviously doesn't exist? I'm purely making hypothetical statements here.
Right. Just speculating.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, and that was going to be one of my questions for you, because before I went to SHOT Show, I put out a post saying, hey, does anybody, you know, have anything they would like for me to check on? And literally the number one request I got was, find out if there's going to be anything new for revolvers in the world of competition. And I had reached out to you before. I missed you there at the Taurus booth, but you know, the resounding answer was no.
Yeah, there was no, you know, and it's interesting because in the revolver space, we're seeing a real revitalization and a real renewed interest in revolvers, but primarily around defensive guns. you know, right. primarily around guns that you would use for concealed carry or home defense or personal protection, which makes sense because in present day, everybody has three ARs and everybody has, you know, three or four 9mm striker fired polymer framed pistols, but they all still like guns. So they want to go buy something else. So they buy a lever gun and a wheel gun. And then they're like, what do I want to do with these things? And they, you know, have to go figure something out. But I think we'll, you know, the competition revolver space is interesting because it is the teeniest of tiniest of markets, right? So
right.
if you yes. look at USPSA as a whole, there's what, 30,000, 40,000 members of USPSA in the United States. And there's 100 million gun owners in the United States, or 80 million. Like, even if you take the conservative estimate of 80 million gun owners, let's do some math. 30,000 divided by 80, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
Times 100 to get a percent. It's not even, it's 0.0375 of a percent of gun right. owners are USPSA shooters, right? And if you do the numbers versus, you know, match participation at a 100-person match, there's three revolver shooters. So
yeah.
make that number even smaller. So it's an interesting space, and you can see why, you know, Smith & Wesson's largely not catering to it anymore. They basically like, here's the products, we'll make them every now and then. You can have them if we make them. Ruger still makes the Super GP 100 Match Champion in 357. They discontinued the 9mm one, which makes sense because it wasn't very good. And I love Ruger. I have friends who work over there, but the gun had problems. So creating a gun specifically for that market, there's certainly a market opportunity for us, but it's also never going to be a volume piece, right? It's not going to be like, you know, the gun that I sell 10,000 units of.
Right. Now, so in your opinion, what is the best size revolver for competition / defensive carry?
Oh, that's interesting. So if I was going to compete with a gun and also carry it, I would probably just use, I'd probably go IDPA side and go with a 6-shot 38 Special 357 Magnum medium frame. So you're, you know, at your GP 100, we in Taurus, we call them medium frames. They're like a little bit K frame, a little bit L frame size. So something in that is going to be your best bet because you can load it up with speed loaders. It's practical. It's small enough to be concealable with a, you know, a modicum of effort, but you will still have a good experience competing at it at an IDPA match. You can take it over to I-Corps matches as well. The problem with USPSA revolver is that it is largely non-reflective of, so USPSA revolver, especially, there's two things. USPSA revolver and three-gun shotgun are the two areas of competition that are the least reflective of the guns that are of those guns and how they're used in the real world. Right. So, okay. you know, three gun shotgun is a reloading race. USPSA shotgun is a reloading race. If you look at actual defensive gun uses involving shotguns, they are generally 1 to 3 round affairs that are solved with the ammunition that is in the gun or on the gun. You know, so, and that's it. Though that's how those guns are used in the real world. And if you look at the revolvers in, you know, in USPSA, the revolver, it has to be in, I think, as much as I loved the 8-shot rule, because it opened up more guns for the sport, it also killed 6-shot guns in USPSA. It has to be, to be competitive in USPSA, you need to be shooting an 8-shot minor gun. If you're running a 6-shot major gun, good luck, God bless, but you're probably going to get you're probably going to have to eat 2 or 3 standing reloads, and that's going to put you out of the game, right? So it's not but if you turn that around and you look at revolvers in the real world, the vast majority of revolvers that are owned for concealed carry and personal protection are small frame 5-shot guns or 6-shot medium frame guns. You know, that's your majority of revolvers on earth are going to fall into one of those two categories. And that's why I think that if you want to compete with a revolver, this goes back to the IDPA thing, your best place to do that is IDPA. Because IDPA even has their Bug R division where you can shoot your five-shot revolver and just hate your life the entire time you're doing it. But you can do it. It's in there. It's in the freaking rules.
Right. So when you say a medium frame revolver, like what barrel length are we talking, or what range of barrel length are we talking?
Usually, so for IDPA, it's got to max out at 4 inches. And I think that's reasonably reflective of the guns in the real world. You know, you'll see 3 and 4 inch guns, and this is your, you know, your GP100s, your Model 66s, your Model 19s. On the Taurus lineup, we have the 82, the 65, that kind of fall into that sort of medium frame category as the gun that kind of fits into both worlds. You know, my Model 82 that I shot last year, it retails for $300, right? You can go and buy it on, you know, at a gun store for $300, shoots 158 grain bullets right behind the tip of the front sight. It is a very common gun for people to buy when they just want some kind of gun, right? Like they walked into a gun store in the middle of the pandemic. The gun store was sold out of Glocks, because that was the only brand that they knew by name was Glock.
Right.
And the guy was like, well, I have this 38 revolver and it's going to be great. So they do that. And that was, you know, a lot of people ended up with guns like that as a result of the pandemic or as a result of a loved one or something along those lines.
That 82, is that a 5 or 6 shot?
6 shot. So if that's okay. Anything, yeah. And again, you know, so you got a 6 shot medium frame, 4 inch barrel. You get good terminal ballistics out of a 4 inch gun.
Yeah.
For concealed carry, I prefer obviously a smaller frame. You know, so I'll run one of our 856s a lot of the time. Or right now, I have the 32 Fed Mag guns that I like a lot. Right now, I'm actually not carrying a revolver because I am doing a month with only semi-automatic pistols. I'm teaching a class with semi-automatic pistols at the end of the month, so I wanted to like get some trigger time on the easy mode guns, which was kind of nice. It's been neat, very easy, simple. Guns are easier to shoot. A modern striker-fired semi-automatic pistol is unquestionably easier to shoot than a revolver.
I want to say it was like maybe 3 or 4 years ago we bought a G2C, my wife and I. And a fun little gun, but it seems like that line of guns has exploded because now there's a G3, there's a G4. Is that line just going to keep progressing?
Yeah, absolutely. So we work, we have the G3 line, which has sort of been the flagship line. And then in the last couple of years, we launched the GX4 line, which is, you know, it started off with a micro compact, then we expanded it to a longer barrel micro compact, and then last year we added the macro compact, right? Like the GX4 carry, so that's your 15 shot, but it's still slim and short, so we added that one. And yeah, there's absolutely plans to continue the GX line as well as the G3 line well into the future. They are reliable, they're accurate. You know, once I started working here, a lot of the people hating on the brand stopped making sense to me because, like, the bottom line is everyone has a right to own a reliable firearm for personal protection, whether it's home defense or concealed carry, right? If you're a law-abiding citizen, you have the right to own a gun for these things. And, you know, bottom line is we make a reliable 9mm semi-automatic striker-fired firearm that costs $250. And if you don't like that, if you're not in favor of that, maybe you don't like the Second Amendment as much as you say you do. You know, maybe in your head you're like, oh, well, I don't want certain people who don't have my economic means to be able to afford guns. You know, I'm just saying, I'm just throwing that out there as a thought. But, you know, we make, yeah, the G3. And I was one of those people that was like, oh, the G3 sucks, right? I have a G3 compact in my closet. It's got 1,500 rounds on it. Is that a lot in terms of competition shooting? No. Is that a lot in terms of what normal people shoot through their guns in a year? Yeah, it's probably 1,400 rounds more than a lot of these guns will ever see in their lifetime, you know? So
Right.
I think that there's a, you know, to get this part out of the way, you know, did Taurus make some jacked up guns in the past? Yes. No one who worked for the company back then still works there. You know, upper level, we've cleaned the joint out, you know, both in the American side and the Brazilian side, by and large. The curve's dead. All of the weird old crappy guns are dead. We got rid of them. You know, we made new designs and everything's pretty much great now. Like, we're in a situation where, one, because we're so vertically integrated as well, because we control so many parts of our manufacturing, the guns don't cost less because we make them cheaply. The guns cost less because we own more of the manufacturing processes, right? I don't have to outsource the same amount of stuff as other manufacturers to make my compact gun, which is why the GX4 costs less than a P365 and does all of the things a P365 does. You know, except having silly one-off rose gold editions. We don't do that. I can if you want. You guys want a rose gold GX4 and like 10,000 of you commit to buying one. Yeah, sure.
A lot of the manufacturers are going to basically everything they put out new is slide optic ready.
Yeah, as it should be. It's 2024, red dot the world.
And it looks like you guys are still offering, though, with and without. When I looked at the GX line.
That's correct. So, and there's a, this has been one of those things where I've had to sort of rethink my position on stuff as a someone inside the industry, because we tend to think that the way the professionals, whether they're on the shooting sports or the training side, are doing things is reflective of the way that these regular earth people are carrying guns. But I am now convinced, and you know, some of this, Carl Wren's done a lot of good work on this as well. Just because me and all my friends are carrying, you know, striker fired pistols with optical sights on them does not mean that's reflective of how most people are carrying guns. And when we talk about a gun, you know, the non-optics ready version, and we make it and it's $30 cheaper or $20 cheaper than the optics ready version, that suddenly becomes an attractive thing for people who don't care about having an optic on their gun. And it turns out that's a lot of people. You know, in terms of sales numbers, you know, I was surprised at how well the non-optics ready guns sell in comparison to the ones that come from the factory optics ready. I was actually quite surprised, because to me, I would be like, why would I not want to have this extra capability? Even if I'm not using it right now, I can have it and I can still shoot the iron sights. But then if I decide I want to upgrade to this extra capability, it's already built into the gun. But my logic is, you know, one of the hardest things for me to accept in this space is my logic is not always the consumer's logic.
Well, and I mean, with you being the general manager of marketing, obviously you are privy to probably some statistics and media numbers for sales. What is the going trend right now?
You know, trend analysis is an interesting thing for us to do, because the number of optics ready pistols that are being sold increases, right? Like, it increases every year. But is that because that's what the market wants, or is it because manufacturers in many cases have simply decided to discontinue the non-optics ready option, right? So, like, you know, if you look at the Glock 19, I'm almost certain that the only Glock 19 that you can buy right now, if you want a Gen 5, is the MOS, right? So there's no non-MOS Glock 19 anymore. So are more optics ready pistols being sold because that's what the market wants, or is it because people want a Glock 19 and the only one they can get is the MOS? And it's also hard then to take into account secondary market sales, right? Like, how many Gen 3 and Gen 4 non-optics ready guns are out there on GunBroker or in pawn shops, or, you know, that sort of stuff. So I think that there is, optics ready guns are still a trend in the sense that they are not the de facto mainstream, right? Like, I guarantee that there are more non-optic ready guns slid across gun counters in the United States of America than optics ready guns. However, I also think that a lot of the optics ready guns that get slid across gun counters never have optics mounted to them. But I think the trend is moving in the direction of optics on everything. I don't know if it will be in my lifetime, but we see manufacturers, Taurus included, we offer SKUs where you just buy the gun and the optic comes pre-installed on the gun from at the factory, right? We have that as an option on a couple of different lines. So, and I think you're going to see more and more of that where manufacturers will either have their own, like, I think it was the Ruger had like the Fast Dot or something that they announced this year or last year. I think you're going to start seeing more and more manufacturers including the optic as part of the package. And I don't know if it will be while I'm still doing this job, but it may be in my lifetime where we just sort of see everything start to come from the factory with a red dot on it.
Do you see more manufacturers getting into, like, SIG makes their own red dots? Canik is getting into red dots. Do you see more gun manufacturers getting in the red dot business?
Well, if they do it the way that SIG and Canik does, where they're just rebadging something that they buy wholesale from China, sure, it's a piece of cake. You know, so I think that, you know, offering a rebadged, you know, Chinese optics line is an appealing thing for manufacturers to have, like, hey, this is the Canik blah, 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 or the, you know, the SIG blah, blah, blah. But I think that I wonder, and this is my personal opinion, if when you start doing that, are you getting away from doing the thing that you're good at, right? Like, I would rather buy my optic separately from a company that makes optics, and that's the thing they're good at, versus having a branded optic from my gun manufacturer that comes pre-installed on the gun, right? Like, I've got, you know, Aimpoint Acros on guns that cost $200, and I've got my Taurus guns have, you know, RMRs and SROs on them, and I like that because these are optics companies. That's what they do. They make optics. So I like getting my milk from the cow, not from a goat. Even though I've heard goat's milk is delicious. So do the thing that you're good. And this is again, personal opinion, do the thing that you're good at, let other people worry about doing the other thing. So I don't know. I'm certain we'll see more of it, you know, and watch, we're going to drop this episode. And like, my boss is going to text me and be like, hey, we're dropping our own optics line. I'm like, frick. So I'm going to edit that podcast.
Dave, I need you to cut that out.
Yeah. Okay, hang on. So let's listen about optics. Let's forget.
Well, I mean, I do feel like if you're going to do it, because I agree with you, you don't want to lose focus as to what your main objective is. Mm-hmm. But, and I feel like if you're going to do an optic, even if it's a rebranding, you need to create like an optics division, people who can focus on that. Yeah. That's their sole focus, so that, you know, maybe they work with that original company to make it more unique and work on quality and whatever you need to do. Because I did find, when I was at SHOT Show, I've got the guy's card and he emailed me afterwards. I found a guy from China at SHOT Show that will put, I could have walked out of there with my own line of optics. The guy was, I
mean, it's big business for them. So, you know,
yeah. I could have the Casual Shooter Podcast logo on there. And then for about, you know, probably $250, sell my own line of optics. $250 for a Casual Shooters Podcast red dot.
And I don't want to, like, I don't want people to think that I'm not in favor of people bringing in more optics, because the Chinese optics market, the Chinese components market has gotten it's gotten tremendously better. You know, there was a time when, like, you would call something Chinesium junk and it would actually be Chinese junk. But if you look at some of the optics with that are being primarily sourced from components made in China and stuff like that, they're solid optics. You know, I have I have a bunch of Holosun optics. They're great. I think they're perfectly acceptable optics. My concern with optics that are sourced from that is I worry, you know, and I, everything, like half of the things in my house have Chinese components in them, right? My phone, the computer that I'm talking to you on, the monitor that I'm watching. I get it. I understand that in this global economy, we are irrevocably economically intertwined with China's economy. That doesn't mean I have to like it. And it doesn't mean that I have to be that if I have the opportunity to source my optics elsewhere, I can. You know, I'll get mm-hmm. an aim point. I'll get a Trigicon. But again, this is no shade, right? Like I know that like the Holosuns I have Chinese source components in them. I know that I'm testing an optic from CNH Precision that is a direct mount for the G3. It's a really good optic. I like it a lot. It's got Chinese components in it. So it's, I really try to not be high and mighty about much these days. You know, the only things that I probably at this point have really strong opinions about are Italian scooters and, you know, Scotch whiskey. But, you know, I understand why, you know, people are price shopping, and I understand why people want to avoid Chinese components. And I think that you should do, you know, whatever you feel is the right thing to do, right? Like if you're comfortable with it, be comfortable with it. Don't let other people talk shit about your optic, especially if it works. You know, that's my there. I think that's what I was trying to get at. My line is about quality. All right. If you go and you spend $250 on an optic and it doesn't work, I don't care where it comes from. You just bought a bad optic and that sucks for you, homie. If you spend $250 on an optic and it works great, congratulations, you got a good one. So like, for example, you know, I like, I have a really good relationship with the guys at Shield Sights that make the RMSC and those. And those optics are all made in the United Kingdom by like, you know, allegedly Western Democratic, you know, a Western Democratic country. I would rather preferentially spend my money there than somewhere else. And the optics work. So that's great. You know, but I'm not, put stuff on your gun that makes you happy. It just has to work. That's the thing. And don't be like, oh, I got such a good deal on this. It's worth it that it fritzes out and eats batteries. No, that's the bad one. That optic's bad.
Right.
Don't be happy about your cheap optic if it actually sucks. But yeah, but like, I think to put a bow on that, the best thing about the Chinese optics market is that it's driven costs down, but quality has gone up. You know, when I first started running a red dot on a gun, I had an M&P that I had cut for a red dot back in like 2012 or 2013. Maybe. And yeah, way back in the day, right? Like, and there was only one red dot. It was the RMR. That was it. That was the only dot that could hold up to being mounted on a pistol slide. And, you know, the Delta Point was out there, but they were pretty fragile. And now you have a gajillion options and they cost like $250 sometimes, and you can stick them on your gun and they're going to work. So, well, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, well, it's Chinese crap. Well, yeah, but it's also driven innovation and technology and has gone up and prices have gone down. So it's hard to hate on that entirely, mm-hmm. you know. Now, if like China invades us and they push some sort of master switch and everybody's Chinese optics turn off, then you're going to be in trouble. And I hope you learned how to shoot with iron sights, but you know, no, it's an interesting space. And again, I try to not be overly dogmatic about a lot of stuff anymore. Cause I think everybody goes through a phase, especially in this space, where it's like, they know the way. You know, whether that way is a Roland Special Glock, because that was my, when I knew what the right answer was, it was during that era when the Roland Special Glock was like the coolest thing. And like, if you weren't carrying a Glock 19 with a reload and, you know, all of this other stuff, you were just going to get killed by ninjas. So that was when I knew what the right answer was. And I try to not do that sort of stuff anymore, because I've realized that this space is tremendously nuanced, and also a lot of the things that we think matter don't matter even in the least bit. So, you know, everybody should probably just like take a deep breath and do a push-up or something.
Now, going back to the trends, what are some of the trends you guys are seeing in the world of revolvers?
Interestingly, the fact that there is trends in revolvers again, it's like not 1970 and people are buying revolvers. But one of the trends that we're seeing is manufacturers building the guns that people actually want instead of just building guns and throwing them out there, right? So like, and this is something that I at Taurus take credit for kind of kicking off, is that we did the executive grade or the original executive grade. And so what happened was we got myself, this was before I worked there, I was just consulting on this project. We got myself, we got some other people, and we put them in a room and we said to these people, if you could design a fighting revolver that you would carry every day, what would it look like? And we said it would be 6 shots, it'd be 38 special, it'd have a good trigger, and it'd be double action only. And then Taurus was like, okay, and made the gun. You know, that was the first executive grade. And we've continued that with other projects. And you see it with the new Lipsy's limited editions with Smith & Wesson, where they took smart people, put them in a room and said, tell me about your perfect J-frame. And then they made it, you know? So that's kind of the trend in the revolver space, is manufacturers understanding that there are, that if they build a gun for the high level end users, other people will buy it too. And that's been a pretty cool thing to see.
Has the trend in revolver sales gone up over the years?
You know, I'd have to look at numbers on that. And I don't, I okay. Mean, maybe, I don't know. Hang on. Let me look at something. I have access to an interesting analytics program that gives me retail sales numbers from a large online retailer, as well as a bunch of gun stores. And I can go look at, I bet you've never had anybody like run a sales report in real time on the podcast before.
I have not. This is a first.
All right. So I'm going to run the last 2 years. Cause that will eliminate the COVID. That'll eliminate the big COVID year. And then we can see trends based on sales. Good Lord. They sold a lot of pythons. Holy cats.
Wow.
So if we look at previous year, 2024 is, everything was down a little bit in 2024, so I'm not sure if this is reflective, but honestly, the spike sort of looks, yeah, the trend, the graph looks pretty consistent from year to year from 20, you know, that's why that's wrong. That's showing me the last 2 years as a running number. Hang on. Let's try something else. Let's go to the calendar, and we're going to go from January of 2021 will be our front date to 12/31/2023. Okay. All right, let's look at this. So yeah, just looking at these numbers, the trend seems there's a huge drop off from 2020, it stays pretty consistent. You know, a lot of people out there buying, buying pythons and stuff like that. But we are I would say it's largely consistent. There's probably been upticks here and there in various, various gun types, various things like that. But for the most part, it looks like a fairly steady trend over the last few years.
So what is it that they have you do in the Air Force Reserve?
I'm what is called a combat arms instructor. So all firearms training in the Air Force runs through the, MOS. We call that AFSC. It's Air Force Specialty Code. So unlike any other branch of the military, firearms instructor is a primary job for people in the Air Force. To get there, you have to go through our security forces / military police school. Then you can retrain into, you got to go through our combat arms school. When I went, it was a 2-month course. And then you go and you get certified on your base and become a combat arms instructor. And you do everything from teaching Depending on the base that you're at, your location, you will teach everything from M9s all the way up to Mod Deuce. I have now been promoted. I've now promoted myself out of doing, well, not, I didn't promote myself, but I've gotten promoted out of doing the fun part, which is actually teaching. And now I'm the old position used to be NCOIC. We just renamed a bunch of stuff in the career field. So now I'm the combat arms trainer, which means I'm the NCOIC of the shop. So I supervise a team of like seven instructors, and we do firearms instruction every, you know, since we're in the reserves, we do it once a month. I've active duty shops will usually run three or four classes a week, things like that. We run three or four, you know, a weekend once a month. And then during our annual tour time, we'll do stuff like heavy weapons training, machine gun quals, stuff like that. So it's been very rewarding for me professionally. And it also helped me recalibrate a lot of the stuff that I talk about not being dogmatic and having perspective comes from teaching in an institutionalized environment for 10 years now, where you realize that a lot of students and a lot of learners, even the ones you don't want to be there, or they are there because they have to be there, and teaching pistol fundamentals of pistol marksmanship to a class of 20 people where they're just there to get the qualification so they can go on the deployment or they can go on the mission or something like that has really helped me in the civilian sector being able to teach to people as well. And it's helped me reframe how I think about regular earth gun owners, right? Because a lot of these people are representative of gun owners in kind of the general market.
And how often do you teach general gun owners, not in the military?
Almost never, because I did it so much in the military. I personally will have, honestly, I will usually have one to two open enrollment classes a year, and they are revolver specific. And they will attract people from a different range of skill sets, but they trend towards more higher skilled shooters and enthusiast shooters, specifically because it's kind of a niche course for weirdos like me. I would love, and what's funny is I would actually love to teach more. I would love to get out there and teach like, handgun 101 fundamental courses, right? Just grind through like a class a week for $100 a head and get 10 people in there. But I don't have the time or the bandwidth for that. I have a small child. I have the Air Force. I have this job, you know? So like choosing between, you know, do I want to spend Friday night on an indoor range with 10 strangers who are paying me to be there? Or do I want to spend it, you know, watching Thomas the Tank Engine with my son? I'm going to pick my kid every day.
Understand. Well, Caleb, that's everything that, I wanted to cover. Was there anything that we didn't talk about that you wanted to?
Oh gosh, probably. But you know, I like to approach these as kind of an open-ended conversation. So, you know, I think the one thing that I would, you know, like to cover is for people out there who are listening to this, who maybe have had a negative brand impression of Taurus in the past. I would like to encourage you not to change your opinion necessarily, but to approach the brand with an open mind again. Approach the products with an open mind. You know, did we make some bad guns in the past? Yeah, but again, we're not that company anymore. So have an open mind when you're looking at the stuff that we're making today.
Sounds good. I know I enjoy my G2C. My wife loves it. So
that's a great gun. That's, you know, that gun has been a fantastic seller for us. And we actually have some, we might have, so hypothetically, there might be some upgrades coming around that line later on. We might see some improvements, because at this point, that's almost a legacy product for us, right? We've had it for a gajillion years in our lineup. We've literally sold millions of them. So maybe it's going to get a refresh. So if you like your G2C, but you maybe want like a slightly refreshed, modernized version, just keep your eyes.
Yeah.
Keep them little peepers out on the internet. You know, maybe something's going to happen. Maybe not. I don't know. I definitely do know, but maybe. So, you know, we'll see.
I will definitely do that, because that would be definitely be a purchase we would do. So, well, Caleb, I appreciate you coming on. It's been a great conversation, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Until next time.
Don't be a little bitch.
Yeah.